From Ground Zero, this is Democracy Now in Exile. Hundreds of militia troops are marching on Kabul. Is civil war imminent? Then, even if the bombing stops, the explosions won't. We'll look at landmines and unexploded cluster bombs in one of the most mined countries on Earth, Afghanistan. And then there's depleted uranium. Finally, we'll speak with a Filipina activist who will begin a solidarity fast on this Ramadan. All that and more coming up. Welcome to the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The London Guardian has confirmed reports that more than 500 Taliban troops were killed in a bloodbath after the capture of the key northern Afghan city of Mazar-i-Sharif. The Northern Alliance has admitted turning tanks and heavy machine guns on hundreds of mainly Pakistani soldiers who'd been holed up in a school after apparently being abandoned by their Taliban leaders and failing to surrender unconditionally. According to eyewitnesses, reports from the city, bodies are still being pulled from the rubble of Sultan Reza School, which Northern Alliance forces fired upon for two straight days. And the U.S. and Northern Alliance have laid siege on the northern city of Kunduz, where up to 20,000 Taliban troops and thousands of civilians are trapped by encircling opposition forces and heavy U.S. bombing. Northern Alliance forces have threatened to wipe out the city if the Taliban troops, including thousands of foreign recruits, do not unconditionally surrender. And several hundred Hazara militia from Afghanistan's Central Highlands are marching on the gates of Kabul today in a bid to defend their fellow Shiite Muslims against persecution by the Tajik-dominated Northern Alliance. The Hazara already captured the town of Bamiyan on Monday. The alliance has strengthened its grip on the capital, bringing in 80 tanks into the city and seizing important ministries. It set up self-styled ministries, a foreign ministry, defense ministry, and interior ministry. Meanwhile, various warlords and tribal chiefs who formerly ruled patches of Afghanistan have returned to exert their control to try to fend off the growing threat of a new civil war between anti-Taliban forces. British troops flew into Afghanistan yesterday and secured a strategic air base for large-scale reinforcements. A unit of about 100 members of the Royal Marines Special Boat Service are at Bagram Airport, north of Kabul, as an advance party for the land forces due to begin arriving on Sunday. 4,000 British troops are on standby, and CNN is showing some of the first pictures of U.S. Special Forces in Afghanistan. We turn now to Steve Coates, who is the Deputy Bureau Chief for AFP, Agence France-Presse, in Islamabad, Pakistan. Welcome to the War and Peace Report. Steve Coates, it's good to have you with us.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
This is not a very good line, so if you could speak as clearly and as loudly as possible. Can you first talk about who these militia are who are now marching on Kabul?
Well, these ethnic Hazara militiamen, the Hazaras represent the Shiite minority in Afghanistan.
Could you speak as loud as you possibly can?
As loud as I can.
Much okay. better.
Okay, the people marching on Kabul today that we have heard of are from the Hazara ethnic minority. They are the Shiite community in Afghanistan, making up only about 2% of the 20 million people in the country. The faction in particular come from the Hizb-e-Wadat group, which is the main armed faction of the Hazara community. Just what the intentions of these people who are on the outskirts of Kabul is, we're not too sure. They say they are simply worried about the security of the Shiite people in the capital, Kabul, and they're not going to enter the city but they are there for the protection of that group in the Afghan capital.
And who are they concerned about? Who is threatening them?
Well, the Hazaras are historically threatened by every ethnic group in Afghanistan. The Tajiks, Uzbeks, the dominant Pashtun group are all Sunnis, and they all have quite deep-seated, almost racist animosity towards the Hazaras. So there is any number of threats against the Hazaras now that the situation in Kabul is so uncertain.
Can you talk about the possibility of civil war? Do you actually see that?
Well, we have civil war now. There has been civil war in Afghanistan since 1992, and most analysts here in Pakistan and people who are familiar with the country can't see any real prospect for peace anytime soon. Now that we have so many different ethnic groups with a head full of steam, they are no doubt going to compete very heavily for power in Afghanistan over the next few months.
What about the ousted Afghan president, Rabbani, returning to the Afghan capital?
Well, he hasn't yet returned. We think he may be returning today or in the next few days. His return obviously would be a very symbolic moment for the Northern Alliance, but we have to remember that the Northern Alliance itself is a very fragile group of ethnic factions, and Rabbani's return will only be a victory to the Tajik group, which dominates the Northern Alliance and which ruled Kabul and Afghanistan from 1992 to 1996, a time of dreadful civil war and internecine fighting between the various ethnic groups. So Rabbani coming back may only aggravate this very volatile situation that we have at the moment.
Hasn't he expressed reservations about any kind of broad-based government?
No, he has said that he is ready to abide by commitments that he has made with the former king living in exile in Rome, which would see a Council of National Unity convened in Kabul with representatives from all the ethnic factions, including the dominant Pashtun, who have most recently supported the Taliban. So Rabbani says he is backing that process, but on the ground since the capture of Kabul on Tuesday, his group has been moving very quickly to stake its claim to as much of the power in the city as it can get before it is asked to make any compromises.
And then you have what have been called in the press warlords, like Rashid Dostum, an ethnic Uzbek, who's returned to Mazar. And then in the main western city of Herat, the Northern Alliance commander Ismail Khan, who's returned to the place where he made his name fighting the Soviets. What is meant by this term warlord? And are we talking about separate kind of fiefdoms around the country now?
Well, yes, this is a fairly loose term. Warlords, though, are a very unfortunate reality of life for Afghanistan and have been for many, many years. Basically, these are men who, for whatever reasons, command the support of large numbers of people in their local areas, and they can raise small armies, they can pay for weapons and machinery, they can buy the support of other commanders. So the warlords that you mentioned, such as Dostum in the north and Ismail Khan in the west, are two of those, but there are many others. Dostum and Ismail Khan are both members of the Northern Alliance. There are others in the east of the country, notably Gulbuddin Hikmetia and Yunus Kullus, whose sympathies lie more with the Taliban. And if they manage to hold on to provinces that they have moved into in the east, it will mean that the Northern Alliance has very hostile groups on its doorstep outside Kabul, and whether these groups choose to participate in any kind of government of reconciliation or national unity is ambiguous at the moment.
Steve Coates, I want to thank you for being with us from Islamabad, a reporter for Agence France-Presse. You are listening to the War and Peace Report.
What is it good for? Absolutely. Nah. Listen to me.
War, Edwin Starr here on the War and Peace Report, broadcasting just blocks from where the towers of the World Trade Center once stood. The burning smell still hangs heavy in the air here where we are. Outside, a police blockade remains with Army Humvees, Army National Guard, State Police continuing to stop cars, vans, and buses as they head down to the tip of southern Manhattan. I'm Amy Goodman. U.S. warplanes are continuing to pound targets around the Taliban home base of Kandahar in the city of Kunduz today, now the main focus of the militia strength after a week of retreat. A spokesperson for anti-Taliban forces said the Taliban will still have control over the southern city of Kandahar, despite being chased out of much of Afghanistan. Since the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan in 1979, landmines and unexploded bombs have made walking across the cratered landscape extremely treacherous. But heavy U.S. bombing over the course of the air campaign since October 7th has greatly increased the risk of civilian casualties in cities and villages across the country. Humanitarian workers say the unexploded and unexpected material on the ground in Afghanistan is all over. Posters on the streets of Kabul warn of the dangers of unexploded bombs. The UN's warned of the landmine and cluster bomb dangers faced by people returning to their homes in Afghanistan, especially the displaced people in Afghanistan's northeast. At least 84,000 people have been displaced by the fighting since last winter. According to the Mine Action Program for Afghanistan, some 100 million square meters of land east of the city of Talakan in Takhar province have been continually mined over the last 2.5 years. In addition, the area has been further contaminated due to the new submunitions and bombs dropped by the U.S. forces. We're going to turn now to Sarah Warren and Richard Lloyd. Sarah Warren is the Program Development Officer of Vietnam Veterans of America, and she moved to Pakistan to work for Save for Children in 1995, where she developed a landmine education program for the children of Kabul. In 1997, she moved to Afghanistan, where she lived for a year under the Taliban regime. Richard Lloyd, a spokesperson for Landmine Action. Let's begin with you, Richard Lloyd. The amount of mines that are in the ground in Afghanistan today.
Well, no one knows the exact number, and we won't know until they've been cleared, the same as every other country that's affected. But what we do know is that before the bombing campaign, there was a very, very serious problem with casualties are in the region of 90 casualties a month. And the information from the ground, from our partner organisations in Afghanistan, was that that number was on the rise, more casualties, as a result of people moving around. And this reflects the situation that we've found in every other conflict, where you get major movements of populations in heavily mined, heavily bombed environments. Then they're wandering into areas where they don't know the risks, and sadly you get more casualties.
How many people have been displaced right now in Afghanistan?
Well, it's the figures that have been put around varying from the hundreds of thousands to the millions. And what we're pointing out now is that as people aim to return to their homes, when they see that the front lines moved further south, for example, there's a very real risk to people moving back into areas where not only are there huge numbers of landmines, but also, as you mentioned just now, the risk from unexploded munitions dropped by the Allies, and in particular, the weapon that people won't know of from the remains of the Soviet occupation are the cluster submunitions that have been dropped by the US Air Force. These are small bomblets, very sensitive, and from our experience in Kosovo and after the Gulf War, these are likely to cause serious casualties because people won't know what they are.
Sarah Warren, you have lived in Afghanistan. Can you, and particularly worked with children and landmines, talk about the scope of the problem?
Well, this is one of the most mine-affected countries in the world, if not the worst. And it's a problem that's been there since the days of the Soviet occupation of the country. But it was only exacerbated when the communist government fell in 92. And then the various factions of the Mujahideen turned and started fighting on one another. What we saw in Kabul was just an astounding situation where huge sections of the city had been destroyed. And there was one area in particular that I remember where the large portion of this section of the city had just been laid to waste. It was layers and layers of rubble. And as the factions were fighting against each other, they laid down their front lines, and as they did that, laid down landmines. When they pushed each other back, the new group that came in would also lay down mines, and then as the fighting occurred, another layer of rubble would be laid on top of that layer of mines. So in the end, after these groups had gone back and forth several times, we ended up with a layer of mines, a layer of rubble, another layer of mines, a layer of rubble. It's what we called the lasagna effect, and this is a nightmare to clear. It's also very challenging to try to help people learn to live in an environment like this where they can keep themselves safe.
Perhaps symbolically, the among the first people killed, or maybe it was only that we only knew that they died because they were connected to international agencies, but were four Afghan D-miners involved with taking mines out of the ground.
Yes, I mean, this was obviously a tragic incident, and the demining program in Afghanistan is quite a sight to behold. It's a huge program, and it's employed thousands and thousands of Afghan deminers. It's almost entirely managed and run by Afghan people. Although it's coordinated by the United Nations, all of the organizations, including the one that lost these four staff members, are Afghan. And, you know, these people go out and take incredible risks every day to clear the country. And it's a very sad incident that took place there.
We're talking to Sarah Warren, who lived in Afghanistan, dealing particularly with children victims of landmines, and Richard Lloyd, spokesperson for Landmine Action. We also learned over these past weeks that the cluster bombs that have been used, that were looked like what Coke, little smaller than Coke cans, bright yellow, similar to the food packages that were dropped on the people of Afghanistan, that these land on the ground, if they don't explode, people can go out, think that they're food. Has this been a problem, Richard Lloyd?
It has. has already, yes. And although the information that we're getting is very limited at the moment, we've had two confirmed incidents where children, in one case, picked up a cluster bomb and were seriously injured, and another case when one civilian was killed and another injured. And I think what we're going to find, obviously at the moment we don't know how extensively these weapons have been used, but what I think we'll find, based again on our experience from Kosovo and from the Gulf War, is that a high proportion of these munitions fail to explode. They're scattered around. Children in particular find them interesting and move them and throw them around and so on. And they're very, very sensitive. They're extremely powerful. They're designed to go through 20 centimeters of armor. And we will, I think, have to expect a high number of casualties caused by these, because people won't know what they are unless there's a very big effort to warn people precisely of the dangers of these munitions. And also because children will have learnt that yellow things that come from the sky contain food. So there's a very real problem here with the coordination of the humanitarian side of this campaign and the military side, for the US Air Force to be dropping yellow food parcels, small yellow food packets, and yellow cluster submunitions that we know are likely to not explode beyond the rates of other munitions. Seems to us to be at best negligence, and it really is the case from our perspective that the use of these weapons isn't tenable in these circumstances and should be stopped.
Sarah Warren, yes, go ahead.
If I could add here, I also worked in Kosovo, and where we did have a significant problem with the cluster munitions that were dropped there and that didn't explode. The figures that they're finding as they clear these things, their estimates are that at least 8%, there was an 8% failure rate. It may have been much higher, maybe closer to 10 or 12%. In some instances, it was probably as high as 30% of the bomblets in a big cluster bomb that didn't explode. So this did cause a very serious problem, and they tend to land on top of the ground. They're bright. They're appealing to people, and especially children, to look at and pick up. And once they explode, they're likely to kill everybody that's standing in the immediate vicinity. So this did create a huge problem for us there. I do know, though, that the Afghan, a couple of technical experts from the Afghan demining program have recently visited Kosovo to try to learn as much as they could about the way that the clearance process was handled in Kosovo. And what would really make a big difference now, now that this has already been done and is clearly going to be an issue, is that they need the information about where these strikes took place. They have to have accurate information about where they might find cluster bombs. That's really the best hope now of trying to reduce casualties that may occur as a result of people coming across these weapons.
Sarah Warren, having worked with children, survivors of landmines and other unexploded bombs, what is the advice you give? I mean, you deal with the after effects when you were living in Afghanistan, but what do you tell children who face this danger? How do you educate families?
Well, essentially what we did with, say, the children in Kabul was to set up a program where we tried to use various techniques, games and activities and whatnot, to engage children, help them to understand, first of all, what these objects look like, just to be able to recognize the basic shapes and sizes, and to try to get across the message that although they may be curious, it really is not worth it to touch or tamper with these objects. And they also need to know where to report something that they see. However, with landmines in particular, they're usually underground, and so people can't see them before they step on them. So you have to teach people the types of areas that are likely to be mined and little signs that could actually indicate that an area might be dangerous. And you've got to teach people to be on the lookout, to be alert really at all times.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Sarah Warren lived in Afghanistan dealing with the issue of landmines, particularly working with children, working closely with the Afghan campaign to ban landmines. She's with Vietnam Veterans of America. And Richard Lloyd speaking to us from Britain with the Landmine Action campaign. And you can get their information websites on ours at democracynow.org. You are listening to the War and Peace Report. When we come back from our live music break with Judy Gorman, we're going to talk about other weapons. We're going to talk about depleted uranium. Stay with us. Judy Gorman, live in our Firehouse studio for this 2 hours of War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. This is the exception to the rulers, Democracy Now! In Exile. Joining the other dangers on the ground in Afghanistan is the possibility that U.S. depleted uranium weapons are being used extensively, employed in the 1991 Gulf War in Bosnia and Kosovo. These, what are known as DU weapons, have already been sent to Afghanistan. There's little indication that the U.S. military has warned soldiers or civilians about the possible adverse health and environmental effects. Over 10 years ago, the U.S. Army released a comprehensive report about what's known as armor-piercing ammunition made of depleted uranium, a chemically toxic and mildly radioactive heavy metal. This report predicted the combat use of depleted uranium depenetrators could create localized areas of contamination consisting of large amounts of inhalable size uranium particles. Infantry troops were expected to receive the highest exposure through inhalation of the dust. The Army anticipated the health outcomes could include cancer and kidney problems. Though no anti-DU movement existed at the time, the Army predicted that depleted uranium munitions might be removed from the arsenal by political force once the health and environmental impacts of depleted uranium were widely known. Then you fast forward 6 months during Operation Desert Storm. U.S. aircraft and tanks shot 320 tons of depleted uranium in Iraq and Kuwait. Thousands of Iraqi tanks, personnel carriers, other equipment were contaminated with DU dust and debris. There are over 100,000 U.S. troops suffering from Gulf War syndrome now. Due to the mixture of exposures in that war, they still lack a common explanation for their illnesses. But many veterans and civilians believe that other toxic exposures affected them, including depleted uranium. We're joined now by Jawad Metni, who is a director-producer of the film Downwind, Depleted Uranium Weapons in the Age of Virtual War, which draws a line from Hiroshima through the Nevada nuclear test site to the sands of Iraq and Kuwait. First, trying to get information on the use of depleted uranium today. Experts are in the process of trying to verify whether the bunker buster bombs and other what are called penetrative weapons being used in Afghanistan contain depleted uranium. Do you know?
I don't know yet. That's something that cannot actually be verified. There are a few websites such as Jane's and the Federation of American Scientists and the Center for Defense Information where there is indications that some of these bigger bunker buster bombs are using what their terminology is a heavy, dense metal in the core for the penetrator part of the weapon. Now, that's the same language they used for depleted uranium and for tungsten penetrator weapons, but they don't actually call it depleted uranium. It seems more than likely that it is, but there's been no reply from either for the UK government or from the United States government.
So it sounds like the US government is changing the language as well in referring to their weapons.
I think it is. That report that you were referring to earlier also indicated that because of the fact that the military use of DU was so effective, they knew also that the health aspects would be looked at and that there would be a movement to ban the weapon, as you said. And so I think that they were trying to find a way to not, or to use cleaner language so that it would not become a problem later on.
So they're saying penetrative weapons rather than depleted uranium?
Exactly. I think obviously a lot of people think they hear the word uranium and they immediately think that it's a radioactive problem, and it seems that that's not actually the case, that it's actually turned out to be more of a heavy metal toxicity problem than an actual uranium radioactive issue. And it may become radioactive issue in the long term, but as it is now, they think the immediate effects short term are heavy metal toxicity.
Let's go to some clips of your film, Downwind. Can you introduce the first?
Sure. The first is it's going to begin with a man named Dan Fahey, who was with the Military Toxics Project for many years, did a lot of work, and did a comprehensive report. And within this clip right now, you're going to see his introduction to DU. You're going to see how the weapon is used and a few other interviews of people talking about it.
Depleted uranium is a naturally occurring heavy metal. It's the waste product of the process to enrich uranium, where highly radioactive parts, or U-235 isotope, is taken out, used for nuclear weapons and nuclear reactors. And then kind of the unusable parts of the uranium is called depleted uranium and is stored in large cylinders. And normally it's kept away from humans and from food and water supplies. In the late 50s, early 1960s, the US government was looking for ways to use depleted uranium, trying to investigate, because they had these growing stockpiles that they didn't know what to do with. They looked for commercial uses. And one of the areas they identified was munitions. So it was in the 1970s that they switched from using tungsten to using depleted uranium. Not because depleted uranium works better, but mainly because they had large quantities of depleted uranium sitting around that they didn't have to pay for up front. And so the decision was made to change over.
I think war is war, and the government will use whatever weapons they feel will win
Carol Gallagher,
a war faster and easier and less expensively. War is hell, but it's also expensive. And if you're using weapons that are made out of nuclear waste, you're doing two things with your dollar. You're cleaning up nuclear waste, and you're killing people at the same time. So economically, it's brilliant.
This is a mock kinetic energy penetrator, and these rounds work on kinetic energy, so they're fired. It's a very dense, heavy metal. There's no explosive charge. It flies through the air at several hundred miles an hour. And when it hits, it's a function of the velocity and the density of the round that enables it to penetrate its target.
Any
and when it does
toxics
that,
project?
A lot of dust gets created, because one of the properties of depleted uranium is that it burns. It's pyrophoric. So all these very fine dust particles get created and they contaminate the area in and around the vehicle that's hit. And if you, you know, the danger is if you inhale that, then you have the alpha radiation in your body.
It's not the same as the uranium dust that you have to deal with in uranium mines or mills. What happens when on impact to a hardened target is that there's a like a flash fire and very, very high temperatures. They run 4,000 to 5,000 degrees centigrade, which is beyond the melting point of uranium. And it acts like a fire in a kiln and turns it into a ceramic. So the uranium oxide aerosol that was released all over the battlefield in the Gulf War was like very small glass particles that were radioactive. And this is what I think is why it's such a major component of the Gulf War syndrome. It's certainly not everything, but I think it's the major part.
Is it dangerous?
Yes, right now it is. You wouldn't want to go into it, but neither would you deliberately walk into a blazing fire. You have to use common sense.
This is a map that the Pentagon released in November of 1998, marking the areas in Iraq and Kuwait where depleted uranium was shot.
This is Dan Fahey of the
On
Military
this map,
Toxics Project.
The pink areas are the areas where the A-10 aircraft shot depleted uranium rounds. The little stars here are where there were tank battles, where the Abrams tanks were shooting depleted uranium. But when the Pentagon released this map, they did so saying that, you know, people are saying this is affecting the health of people in Iraq, but we just don't believe it. And, you know, if you look at this map, most of the depleted uranium that was shot in uninhabited areas of southern Iraq. But it also shows that every American division went through areas where depleted uranium was shot at least once. The number of Marines who were down here went into Kuwait and Army troops that were involved in the ground war was 436,000, according to the Pentagon. So that means 436,000 people went through these contaminated areas.
Again, that was Dan Fahey of the Military Toxics Project, part of the film Downwind, Depleted Uranium Weapons in the Age of Virtual War, produced and directed by Jawad Metni, who joins us in our Firehouse studio. As we talk about the issue of depleted uranium, again, the military changing the terms now, what we did call DU weapons in the Persian Gulf War, even in Kosovo, are now being called penetrative weapons. You have a second clip from your film.
There is a second clip. I don't know if you want to talk a little bit more about DU first, or are we going to go to the second clip? As it is now, again, they've always been called kinetic energy penetrator weapons. They went through, as Dan talked about, this chronology from tungsten, or beginning with lead, to tungsten, to DU, and DU being the cheapest and most abundant source, they went to that. And it also works very well because of its pyrophoric properties.
And explain bunker buster bombs and why you believe that these use depleted uranium. What are they for?
They're basically hard target penetrator weapons, and there's a whole class of these kinds of weapons that are being used. The GBU 29, 30, 31, 32, these are all numbers for different kinds and different sizes of penetrator weapons and smart bombs that have been refitted with penetrator weapons. So these bunker buster bombs are 5,000 pound bombs, and they think that 4,400 pounds of that is depleted uranium or this heavy core dense metal. It's not certain that it's depleted uranium, but it's more than likely that's what it is. If that's the case, then it's been reported that 500 of these bombs have been dropped already in Afghanistan. So when you look at the numbers that were dropped in Kosovo, maybe 10.5 tons of depleted uranium, we're already going on by orders of magnitude much greater than that, and much greater already than the Gulf War if it is depleted uranium.
Let's go to the second clip.
All right.
Sustained and attained, that is just so overwhelming that any battle can be over real fast. And that's what uranium munitions give.
Yeah.
It kills everything.
This is Dr.
It's
Doug
a very
Rocky.
Effective weapon. Again, what this is all about is you cannot spread solid uranium munitions all over everybody's backyard, contaminate the world, and not take responsibility. There is no place in in the United States or any place else that I know of that you could take a handful of solid uranium and throw it all over anybody's backyard in their sandbox where the children are playing.
According to numbers released by the Department of Defense, approximately 320 tons of depleted uranium was used during the ground war in Operation Desert Storm.
Is Dan
we don't
Fahey
know how
again?
Much was in Iraq and how much was in Kuwait, but 320 tons was used. In Kosovo, approximately 10.5 tons of depleted uranium was shot. In Bosnia, it's not clear, though it was, I think, a few tons, 2 or 3 tons.
I would say the depleted uranium weapons are weapons of indiscriminate destruction because it lands on the surface of the ground and can be resuspended in the air if it's disturbed, say by a vehicle going by somebody running, just your feet can resuspend it, or the wind could resuspend it. So it's also has some of the characteristics of a landmine that will continue to act long after the war is over.
The war, in its manner of preparation, execution, representation, is inhabiting this realm, this virtual realm of, you know, war games, simulations. But then the actual execution of it and how it's being portrayed to the American public has this element of the virtuous and sense of ethical. Rules of engagement very tight. Low collateral damage allowed. High munition, you know, high precision munitions. This idea that you can fight a war cleanly. Well, that's true, but it's for one side.
That was Professor James Derderian, International Relations at Amherst University, speaking about the virtual war and the movement towards kind of virtual warfare with using high-tech weaponry and detached video imagery. I think one last thing to note is Dr. Rosalie Bertel, the woman before him, speaking about the fact that these weapons can be thought of in the same sense as landmines, that they're indiscriminate weapons and that their effect is not as immediate, and you can't, you know, obviously, it's going to be a long-term battle, and people are going to be coming down with cancers and leukemias 20, 30 years down the road. But it can be thought of in that sense in terms of trying to sustain or build a coalition against it and to ban the weapon.
So it seems the war never ends, even when the bombing stops.
No, it keeps going for 4.5 billion years.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us again. Jawad Metni is director and producer of Downwind, Depleted Uranium Weapons in the Age of Virtual War. If people want to get a hold of this film, how long is it, by the way?
It's 50 minutes long. There's a website for the film at www.pinholepictures.com, and on that site there's also a page with links to various sources for depleted uranium information. Some good, I think, very good sources for depleted uranium.
Thank you very much for being with us, and people can go to our website at democracynow.org to get all of the contact information. You are listening to the War and Peace Report. We'll be back in a minute.
It's justice we need, not more killing. Nobody's hands are clean. There'll be no peace for the living till we know what the dead really mean. 'Cause an eye for an eye isn't Jesus. It's not Buddha, Muhammad, or God. Nobody gets into heaven with a murder crusade or jihad. Is it evil that makes men such killers? Some race or religion we hate? Is it the rich and the poor locked in a war? Is it fear? Is it rage? Is it fate? It's one world, one people one future. Nothing else makes any sense. We're all in this together, in the slaughter of innocence. We're all in this together. We'll live and die together. We're all in this together, in the slaughter.
Moss Henry, Slaughter of Innocence. Moss Henry sent in this CD of his music, and we would also like to hear from you. If you have music that you recommend or CDs you'd like to send in, you can email us at mail@democracynow.org. You are listening to the War and Peace Report. By the way, I'm looking forward to coming to Troy, New York tonight at 7 o'clock at WRPI, and people can call there outside of Albany to find out about the event tonight. And tomorrow night, very much looking forward to being with the founder of the son of the founder of Pacifica Radio, David Moore, son of Lou Hill, who will be in Washington, D.C., along with Juan Gonzalez. I'll also be speaking at an event tomorrow night at 6 o'clock Saturday night at All Souls Church as we talk about the original mission of Pacifica Radio. Today we continue on the theme of war and peace as we've been doing over the last weeks, more than a month. Philippine President Gloria Arroyo is arriving in the United States for meetings with President Bush. She's expected to ask Bush for Huey helicopters made by Bell Textron, Cobra helicopter gunships, and C-130 troop transports to help the Philippine military in its war against Abu Sayyaf guerrilla movement on the southern island of Mindanao. Abu Sayyaf guerrillas released 7 hostages from months of captivity today to mark the start of the holy month of Ramadan. Since September 11th, the Philippines has opened the Clark and Subic Bay air bases as staging points for the U.S. bombing of Afghanistan, 10 years after the Philippine Senate voted to close the bases and kick the United States out. The Philippine vice president also said the Philippines would be prepared to join a UN-sponsored peacekeeping force in Afghanistan and that the military's war in Mindanao had prepared it for action in Central Asia. We're joined right now by Joanne Carling, who is with the Cordillera People's Alliance in the Philippines. We're also joined by Potri Rancamanes, who is a Muslim Filipina activists, and we welcome you both to the War and Peace Report. Potri, you're going to be fasting. Can you tell us why? More than the traditional daily fast in Ramadan.
Tomorrow is the first day of Ramadan, November 17. And fasting has been there traditionally every year for the Muslim people. However, in my point of view as a Muslim woman, it would be beyond the religious obligation. It's supposed to be a demonstration to tell the world that hunger is suffered by 2/3 of the world. And here in USA, people can eat 5 times a day. So I'm trying to call for do you Ramadan or join Ramadan for the non-Muslims to stand in solidarity with the Muslim people who are actually under attack. Fasting with the Muslims, not necessarily from sunrise to sundown. It can be 1 hour, 2 hour, 3 hours, refraining from smoking, drinking, or eating, announcing to the world that we are doing this particularly to stand in solidarity with the Muslim people. And as a Muslim from the Philippines, it has been what is being undergone by the Muslims right now after the September 11 event is but magnifying what I had experienced since I was a child. This discrimination of Muslim people in the Philippines has been there since the taking over of the Spaniards for 300 years, and then Americans came. In fact, 45 caliber was particularly created for the Moro people, the Muslim people of Mindanao. And since the Moro people resisted, or the Muslim people of Mindanao resisted the coming in of colonization or the neo-colonization, there's a lot of created, like the Abu Sayyaf was created by the CIA, actually. They came up in 1980 under the funding and support of the CIA, and was trained in Afghanistan. And when they came home to the Philippines, they were retraced right now, just like the way the Al-Qaeda or Bin Laden is being traced.
The U.S. government, the president and the administration have talked about Abu Sayyaf and the guerrillas in the Philippines. We're also joined on the telephone by John Gershman, who's just written a very interesting piece for Foreign Policy and Focus. He's the Asia-Pacific editor there. Can you talk about the history of Abu Sayyaf and Potri Rangkamanis's allegation that it was that Abu Sayyaf guerrillas were created by the CIA?
I would just phrase it slightly differently, in the same way that we talk about now how CIA funding of the Mujahideen in Afghanistan created the conditions for the emergence of the Taliban and in part for the rise of Al-Qaeda. I would say that similarly, the founder of Abu Sayyaf was a Filipino who in the 1980s spent time with the Mujahideen, and so therefore was part of this broader process of the United States funding Islamist guerrillas in Afghanistan against the Soviet Union. So part of this realpolitik, Cold War strategy, provided resources and training for which the founder of the Abu Sayyaf was a participant. And when he returned to the Philippines and established Abu Sayyaf, was believed to have some initial setup funding from the Al-Qaeda network, although evidence of that funding existing beyond 1995, no one claims that they have any evidence of that. But I think we can see the Abu Sayyaf and similar kinds of organizations as emerging out of the kind of cauldron of political instability and unrest that the CIA and Pakistani's intelligence services, Saudi Arabia, and so forth, created in Afghanistan in their single-minded effort to combat the Soviet Union.
We're also joined in the studio by Joanne Carling with the Cordillera People's Alliance in the Philippines. You have your president in the United States right now here in New York, then going to meet with President Bush. There's going to be a protest in front of the Philippine consulate on Sunday. It seems that Gloria Arroyo is on a military shopping tour.
Yes, we agree with that. That's why we fear so much that the Philippines will now be unnecessarily dragged to the war, and we believe that it will cause more human rights violations, not only in the south of the Philippines, but other parts of the Philippines, especially when they're going to reactivate the military bases. And of course, we all knew that in the past, when the U.S. used these bases, there were a lot of abuses committed against the indigenous peoples there, specifically the Aitas. There's a lot of prostitution and abuses of women. The toxic waste has never been taken care of, and no compensation and rehabilitation were done properly. So we believe all these problems will be back once we will be dragged into the war, because of the active participation of the Philippine government without the full support of the Filipino people to this they call the war against terrorism, but we believe it's far beyond the issue of terrorism, but more on how the U.S. will try to further strengthen its control again in the Philippines.
Now, the Filipino people had forced the U.S. military out of those bases.
Yes.
Now the Philippine government has allowed them to use these bases as a staging ground. What's the distinction?
Well, before it was under an agreement, but now it's under the Visiting Forces Agreement, also passed by the Philippine Senate. And it's a broad kind of agreement where it allows U.S. access to Philippine lands and airspace. So that provision has been used as an excuse for, again, the direct intervention of military troops in the Philippines.
John Gershman, as you hear the products, military weapons that the president of the Philippines is here shopping for, it sounds like the number one winner of this so-called war on terrorism are, corporations like Bell Textron.
Oh, sure. This is, you know, defense contractors are going to be big winners here, and not only in the Philippines, but Indonesia and other places, of course, and that this is, you know, a way to kind of give a jump start again to what had been, particularly in Southeast Asia, declining markets for arms sales because of the Asian economic crisis. But now they're going to be back in action and selling as much as they can.
And what's the deal with Lockheed Martin?
Well, Lockheed in particular, I don't have any particular information on Lockheed. Certainly, one of the things that's going to be a little unclear is exactly how much the U.S. is going to cough up through foreign military financing. Secondly, is how much the Philippine government is going to be able to come up with to actually make additional purchases. So the exact parameters of exactly who's going to benefit, I'm a little unclear on it at this particular moment, but certainly the defense contractors as a whole are going to benefit.
Lockheed Martin, I understand, will be setting up a collaboration with the Philippine government working on airplane servicing at one of the air bases. So the U.S. military contractor will be back on one of those bases.
Yeah, that's in Clark Airstrip in central Philippines. And we all know that war is a big business for a lot of companies in the U.S. And the other effect, we believe, of this war, as seen already in the Philippines, is on the mining industry, wherein they are the price of gold has risen up because of the war, and the need and the demand for other minerals is also being up. And now there's a lot of mining applications by multinational mining companies in the Philippines. So we believe it provides an opportunity again for them to make a big business.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us, Joanne Carling of the Cordillera People's Alliance in the Philippines, as well as Potri Rangkamanis, with who is a Muslim Filipina activist. On Sunday here in New York, from 3:30 to 5:00, there will be a protest at the Philippine Consulate at 556 Fifth Avenue between 45th and 46th Streets near the United Nations. That does it for the program. Democracy Now! In Exile is produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, Miranda Kennedy. Anthony Sloan is our engineer and music maestro. Again, this weekend, tonight, I'll be at WRPI at the Chapel and Cultural Center at 7:00, and tomorrow night in Washington, D.C. at All Souls Church at 16th and Columbia with the son of the founder of Pacifica Radio and Juan Gonzalez. In exile from the embattled studios of WBAI, the studios of the Bend and the Fire, the studios of our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
You say you're in control, you say you're right, you say too much, too loud, too long.
From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now! In Exile. Does Citibank support Osama bin Laden? We'll look at how multinational banking giants have been lobbying to scuttle banking legislation designed to crack down on money laundering and terrorist financing. Energy giant Enron is bought out by smaller rival Dynegy in a $9 billion deal, with Enron chair Ken Lay so closely tied to the Bush administration. How could this happen, and what does it mean? And from the WTO to the G20, from Qatar to Ottawa, the fight against corporate globalization. All that and more coming up. Welcome to the War and Peace Report, broadcasting just blocks from the first Ground Zero. Afghanistan is the second. I'm Amy Goodman. The London Guardian has confirmed reports that more than 500 Taliban troops were killed in a bloodbath after the capture of the key northern Afghan city of Mazar-i-Sharif. The Northern Alliance has admitted turning tanks and heavy machine guns on hundreds of mainly Pakistani soldiers who'd been holed up in a school after apparently being abandoned by their Taliban leaders and failing to surrender unconditionally. According to eyewitness reports from the city, bodies are still being pulled from the rubble of Sultan Riza School, which Northern Alliance forces fired upon for two straight days. And the U.S. and Northern Alliance have laid siege on the northern city of Kunduz, where up to 20,000 Taliban troops and thousands of civilians are trapped by encircling opposition forces and heavy U.S. bombing. Northern Alliance forces have threatened to wipe out the city if the Taliban troops, including thousands of foreign recruits, do not unconditionally surrender. Meanwhile, several hundred Hazara militia from Afghanistan's Central Highlands are marching on the gates of Kabul in a bid to defend their fellow Shiite Muslims against persecution by the Tajik-dominated Northern Alliance. The Hazara already captured the town of Bamiyan on Monday. The alliance has strengthened its grip on the capital, bringing in 80 tanks into the city and seizing important ministries. The alliance has set up self-styled ministries, a foreign ministry, defense ministry, and interior ministry. Meanwhile, various warlords and tribal chiefs who formerly ruled patches of Afghanistan have returned to exert their authority. To try to fend off the growing threat of a new civil war between anti-Taliban forces, British troops flew into Afghanistan yesterday and secured a strategic air base for large-scale reinforcements. A unit of about 100 members of the Royal Marines Special Boat Service are at Bagram Airport north of Kabul as an advance party for the land forces due to begin arriving on Sunday. 4,000 British troops are on standby. CNN is showing photographs, some of the first of U.S. Special Forces in Afghanistan. Two French intelligence agents are claiming that the government of George W. Bush, under the influence of U.S. oil companies, initially blocked U.S. Secret Service investigations on terrorism while it bargained with the Taliban the delivery of Osama bin Laden in exchange for political recognition and economic aid. In the book Bin Laden, The Forbidden Truth, that appeared in Paris this week, the authors reveal that the Federal Bureau of Investigations Deputy Director John O'Neill resigned in July in protest over the obstruction. They say O'Neill told them that the main obstacles to investigate Islamic terrorism were U.S. oil corporate interests and Saudi Arabia. The two claim the U.S. government's main objective in Afghanistan was to consolidate the position of the Taliban regime to obtain access to the oil and gas reserves in Central Asia. They affirm that until August, the U.S. government saw the Taliban regime as a source of stability in Central Asia that would enable the construction of an oil pipeline across Central Asia from the rich oil fields in Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, and Kazakhstan through Afghanistan and Pakistan to the Indian Ocean. The Pentagon said the U.S. will move ahead with aggressive testing of missile defense after President Bush and Vladimir Putin failed to reach agreement on U.S. plans for space-based missile defense. And National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice and War Secretary Donald Rumsfeld said the U.S. will pursue further testing regardless of Russia or the treaty. Lawmakers agreed yesterday to replace the private contractors that screen passengers and bags at the nation's airports with federal employees within a year, ending a contentious month-long debate over how to guard against future attacks in the air. For weeks, lawmakers argued over airport security. The Senate passed a bill last month creating a 28,000-person federal screening force, asserting airport security is a law enforcement duty that should be handled by the government. But the House, with the support of President Bush, approved legislation that would give the president the choice of hiring public or private employees to screen bags. Under the compromise, all airports will have federal screening within a year of the bill's enactment. After another year, five airports of varying sizes will have the option of hiring private contractors to do the screening. As a concession to House Republicans, all airports would have the choice of using public or private screeners after 3 years. The main impetus for the House Republicans fighting the Senate bill was that with federal employees, they did not want to be dealing with unions. Smooth operator, Sade, here on the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In the weeks after the September 11th attacks, President Bush said a key element in America's so-called war on terrorism will be identifying and cutting off the sources of financial support for terrorists. Bush has since signed an executive order freezing the financial assets of several alleged charities that Bush says are fronts for the Al-Qaeda network. Congress recently passed legislation as part of the anti-terrorism bill, which the Bush administration says will help to close loopholes which make it possible for terrorists to launder their money, and European governments have been working to pass similar legislation. Over the years, the worlds of terrorism and dollar-based global finance have in fact become so entwined that Bush himself appears at one point in his career as a private businessman, an oilman, to have been involved financially with associates of a Persian Gulf banker named Khalid bin Mahfouz. Mahfouz has now been identified in press reports as a source of financial support for an Al-Qaeda charitable front, a powerful example of just how far the tentacles of terrorist-linked offshore money have reached into the fabric of American finance. Achieving the goal of cutting off the terrorists from their sources of financial support will require much more than presidential speeches. It'll require investigators to probe America's mightiest banks and the practices that allow criminals to use them in order to launder their funds. Elise Bean is with us. She's chief counsel for the Senate Permanent Committee on Investigation and lead researcher on a three-phase investigation chaired by Democratic Senator Carl Levin into how lax practices by some of our largest banks have allowed criminals around the world to launder money in the U.S. Elise Bean, welcome to the War and Peace Report.
Good morning. How are you?
It's good to have you with us. You've been working on the issue of money laundering for years. But until September 11th, you face fierce opposition from big banks like Citibank and much of Congress and your efforts to tighten loopholes that criminals use to launder money in this country. Can you talk about how the September 11th attacks and the recent investigations into Al-Qaeda's financing have changed this?
Well, I think they show the cost of letting terrorism and terrorists and other criminals use our financial systems against us. After the attack, we saw a photo of some of the terrorists in front of an ATM machine in the United States. We heard about how they were using credit cards, wire transfers, and checks to accomplish their terrorist acts. And for me, one of the most chilling things was a statement attributed to Osama bin Laden in a Pakistani paper saying that his modern new recruits knew the cracks in Western financial institutions like they know the lines in their hands. That's a very chilling statement, and what it said to those of us in the money laundering field that is that just like we have to tighten up the controls at our borders and our airports, we need to tighten the controls on who we allow into the U.S. financial system, and we have to be a lot more careful about that.
Can you talk about the banks that you investigated?
Well, we did, for the past 3 years, we've done a very lengthy investigation resulting in two reports and a number of hearings. Our latest one was released about 6 months ago. It's a 450-page report with 10 case histories of how certain foreign banks were opening accounts at U.S. banks called correspondent accounts and were using those accounts to move money associated with drug trafficking, financial fraud, and other crime. Some of those examples, just to give you one, there was a shell bank owned by a gentleman in Ireland. It was licensed in Antigua. He ran it out of his house in Ireland. Nobody in Ireland knew that. Virtually every dime that we looked at that went through that bank was associated with some sort of criminality. He was able to open an account at a large international bank that had an office in Jersey. That is Standard Bank of Jersey, which then opened up an account at a bank in New York. The bank in New York had no idea that by handling the larger bank's accounts, it was also handling money for this shell bank as well as over 40 other very highly questionable banks. What we did in our report is I tried to identify three kinds of banks that have high money laundering risks: shell banks that don't have a physical presence anywhere, offshore banks, and banks in jurisdictions with very weak banking controls, places like Afghanistan, Sudan, and others. And what we've said to U.S. banks is you have to be a lot more careful about the foreign banks that you're allowing to open up accounts in our country.
Were you able to trace any U.S. bank support for the Taliban?
Well, we found a couple of, you know, very disturbing things. To use an older example, there is a bank called the Al-Shamal Islamic Bank in Sudan. Sudan is a country that has virtually no banking controls or oversight. The State Department said in 1996 that bin Laden helped to set up this bank and provided it with $50 million in initial capitalization. What we heard earlier this year at criminal trials in New York by a former bin Laden operative is that he was working out in Texas, in Arlington, Texas. He had $250,000 wired to him from the Al-Shamal Bank in Sudan through Bank of America out to a Bank of America branch out in Texas. He then used this money to buy a plane capable of shipping Stinger missiles. He flew the plane back to Sudan and personally handed over the keys to bin Laden. So that was an older example back in the mid-1990s. But that bank was able to open up correspondent accounts at a number of U.S. banks, including Citibank, American Express, as well as banks around the world. Now, once Sudan was put on our list of countries that support terrorism, those accounts were mostly frozen. But it shows you how terrorists are very much aware of the ways that they can use foreign banks and other means to get into our country. In the September 11th attack, we all heard about money exchange houses in Dubai sending money through Citibank and other U.S. banks to get money to Mohammed Atta so that he could carry out his terrorist activities.
We're talking to Elise Bean, Chief Counsel for the Senate Permanent Committee on Investigation, lead researcher on an investigation by Senator Carl Levin into how the largest banks of this country are involved with money laundering. Let's talk about Citibank, Chase, Morgan Stanley for a minute. And what you found they were involved with. I mean, Citibank, their support for the brother of the former Mexican president, Raul Salinas, drug laundering, etc., started to shed light on what these banks do as private bankers for criminals. Can you talk more about that?
We did an investigation in 1999 into private banking. Private banking are the types of banks that cater exclusively to the very wealthy. You usually have to have $1 million or more to open up an account at one of these banks. And what you get in return for your money is you get a private banker who will cater to your needs and help you work the system. That often includes things like setting up offshore shell corporations to open the accounts in the names of these shell corporations, to move money around to various accounts and invest in various ways, so that you can profit from your funds. And what we found in our investigation, we focused on four C foreign senior government officials or their close relatives were able to open accounts at Citibank Private Bank and move their money around. We looked at Mr. Salinas, who was brother to the president of Mexico at the, back then. We looked at Mr. Bongo, who is the head of Gabon, a country in Western Africa. We looked at Mr. Zardari, who was the husband of Benazir Bhutto, who was then the head of Pakistan. And we also looked at Mr. Abacha, who was then the head of Nigeria. And in each case, we found that over $100 million for each one of these individuals was moved through the Citibank Private Bank. When somebody actually loots their country, you wonder, how do they do it? One of the ways that we found is that they were using private bankers. And the problem that we found is that the private bankers were reluctant to ask questions about the source of the funds presented to the private bank for movement. And one of the things that's done in the Levin bill that was included in the anti-terrorism bill is to say to American banks, it is going to be a legal requirement for you to ask some of these questions and to be particularly sensitive to the possibility of foreign corruption funds going through your accounts.
Elise Bean, can you talk about how these banks lobbied to move in to stop the legislation being put forward to expose what it was that they're doing?
Well, we had a bill that, not just us, but this was a bipartisan effort from both parties. We had people like Mr. Leach in the House, Senator Grassley, and others who were working with us to try to shape legislation to get our banks, and not only banks, but other institutions like securities firms and money transmitters, to be more careful about the funds that they handle and who they allow into the U.S. financial system. Our legislation, to be honest, didn't attract a lot of attention prior to September 11th. After that, it did attract a lot of attention as people realized the cost of not doing something about this. Also, to be fair, a lot of what our bill did was try to codify what the banks were supposedly doing for all these years. For many years, banks are supposed to have been careful about who they allowed to open accounts at their institutions, but they weren't doing a good enough job. And we think part of the reason why is they didn't have a legal requirement. It didn't have the force of law to use due diligence. Instead, they were working, this was just best policy as enforced by our bank examiners, but there was no regulation or statute requiring banks and other financial institutions to use due diligence. That's one of the main things that we did in our bill. We also, for the first time, prohibited U.S. banks and securities firms from opening accounts for shell banks, which are the hardest to regulate out there and have very high money laundering risks. It surprised me how many banks did not want to give these requirements the force of law, since they were, you know, many of these banks have very sophisticated systems in place and have been making very sincere efforts to try to protect the United States financial system from criminals and terrorists who are trying to use our financial institutions against us. But we were able to prevail. There were some banks that were not happy with our efforts, but to be fair, there were also banks that were very supportive, and other institutions were very supportive. So there's a lot of grumbling out there, but in the end, we were able to enact this into law.
We're talking to Elise Bean, Chief Counsel for the Senate Permanent Committee on Investigation, as she talks about money laundering and this country's major banks, from Chase to J.P. Morgan to Citibank. So what, in fact, now are the laws? And also I wanted to ask the question of, can you talk about the differences between money laundering as practiced, for example, by Al-Qaeda and as practiced by drug cartels?
That's actually a very important question, because money laundering traditionally has been criminals such as drug lords who are engaged in illegal activity, stealing money, producing money illegally, and then trying to run it through a bunch of bank accounts so that no one knows of its criminal origin. Terrorists they sometimes use drug money or other illegal money, but sometimes they receive money legally, such as donations and charitable organizations. But they intend to use those funds for illegal activities, such as terrorist acts. So we have now expanded the definition of money laundering to include both types of misuse of money, both to hide its criminal origin and to use it for illegal activity. What the bill does, in addition to expanding the definition of money laundering, is it takes aim at some of these foreign institutions that have money laundering risks. For the first time, we're barring U.S. banks and security firms from opening accounts for shell banks. And we're saying if you want to do business with offshore banks or banks in jurisdictions with very weak money laundering laws, then you have to use due diligence. You have to ask some extra questions and be sure that the institution you're dealing with is a legitimate one. In addition, there's a set of provisions that was developed primarily by Senator Kerry and Congressman LaFalce and also Congressman Leach that gave the Treasury Secretary new authority to protect the U.S. marketplace from institutions and countries that are not careful enough about anti-money laundering protections. They can bar U.S. financial institutions from opening accounts for these areas, or they can also impose certain record-keeping requirements. Again, what we're saying to the rest of the world is, look, if you want to get into the U.S. marketplace, you have to play by our rules, and you have to be very careful about who you allow into the United States.
What stake do these biggest banks, from Citibank to Chase to Bank of America to J.P. Morgan, have in fighting the legislation that is being put forward right now, a multi-billion dollar industry of money laundering?
Well, many of these banks, especially the largest ones as the ones you've mentioned, have already invested millions of dollars into anti-money laundering programs, including wire transfer analysis and customer due diligence. So in many ways, they're already doing, they've made the investments necessary for these programs. But what's at stake here is that, for example, let's take charities. Saudi charities can represent huge deposits. No bank likes to turn down deposits. It's no longer enough to say, oh, I'm a charity, therefore you should let me open an account at your institution. Now our banks and our securities firms are going to have to ask some questions about those charities. For example, calling up regulators in their home jurisdiction saying, is this charity engaged in good works? Is this a charity that I have to be concerned about? Anytime you have to ask questions about your customers, that makes a financial institution uncomfortable. No one wants to have to turn away business. But what we're saying to our banks is just like at our borders, we have to ask our people want to come into our country more questions. Just like we all have two-hour waits at the airports, now we're asking our financial institutions to take those extra steps to make sure they're not dealing with terrorists or other criminals that want to use our financial system against us.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. I also want to know if you turned up in any of your investigations as something that is particularly relevant today, though it goes back decades, is George W. Bush as a private businessman, as an oil man, having one of his first companies, Arbusto Oil, bailed out by, it is believed, through an intricate series of connections, the brother of Osama bin Laden, Salim bin Laden, who's dead right now.
You know, I don't know very much about that. I'm afraid I'm unable to comment.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us, Elise Bean. And we will continue to follow the intricate web of money laundering by major U.S. banks. Elise Bean is the lead investigator on the report for Democratic Senator from Michigan, Carl Levin, on bank laundering. You are listening to the War and Peace Report. Back in a minute.
When rich folks act like poor folks, and poor folks eat like rich, when all folks take the high road, and no one's in the ditch, when mothers and fathers around the world can rear their children strong, when everyone in every land can sing a freedom song, then we'll have peace, then we'll have peace. For peace is based on love and trust, thus no man lives on man, and all shall own their native soil, though it is ancient land. And peace is based on tolerance, thus all shall be heard, goodwill towards all, and peace on earth. If there's a God, then that's the word. There shall be peace. There shall be peace.
Judy Gorman in our Firehouse studio here at the War and Peace Report. This is Democracy Now in Exile, Refugee Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. There's a piece in the Montreal Gazette that says, it's important for global financial leaders to meet this weekend in Ottawa to prove the world will not be intimidated by terrorism. This a comment of Canada's federal finance minister, Paul Martin. If nobody stands up to the terrorists, they will think they have won, Martin said, on the eve of meetings of the G20 economic leaders. Going one step farther, Martin said he hopes leaders agree to the new action plan he's proposing that would freeze the flow of terrorist funds. We're going to go now from Qatar to Ottawa, and we're going to begin in what happened in Qatar, where the World Trade Organization just wrapped up its meetings. Among the people who were there was Lori Wallach, one of a handful of protesters who got in. Welcome to the War and Peace Report, Lori.
Good morning.
Lori Wallach is director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. Can you summarize for us what happened?
Well, the same agenda that the European Union and the U.S. and the WTO staff have been pushing for a grandiose WTO expansion, the so-called Millennium Round, was on the table, and the climate there was very closed. Obviously, there was no outside protest, and the process by which the WTO staff had set up the meeting was designed to stick it to the developing countries, who are the majority of the WTO members, to exclude them from meetings, to steamroller the process, and remarkably, despite that, and I would say in part because of what were hundreds of actions around the world for the week before and during this meeting, the developing countries really stuck together, pushed back on this big WTO expansion to new issues like investment, and what came out was not a grandiose round of negotiations, but maybe a semicircle. Unfortunately, though, and so that's the good news. Unfortunately, the very bad news is the WTO is so dreadful as it is that the big push of the developing countries and civil society was for a turnaround to change the existing rules, and that was totally dismissed. That was a major loss. Obviously, we need big changes in the existing rules, and that was totally ignored. The good news was the grandiose expansion also didn't work. And as a symbol that we're starting to make some ground, the WTO was forced, as was the U.S., into making a political statement in favor of the developing country and civil society position on limiting how the intellectual property rules of the WTO are interpreted so as to make it easier for poor people to get access to medicines such as AIDS drugs. But the attempt to actually force a legal change in those rules also failed. So I would say it's a standstill, which is a catastrophe, because it's such a bad deal, with some modest agreements to negotiate on a handful of items, which, you know, is also bad news, but was not the steamroller we expected.
And what about the scene of protest? Well controlled there.
Well, I have to say, interestingly, that the Qatari guards were friendlier than the Seattle police in that we did put on a handful of protests, obviously very small, very controlled, and it was all inside this incredibly locked down, crazed tomb of security. The guards would occasionally look to see if anyone was watching and give us the thumbs up, because a lot of the issues we were raising are issues that they cared about, and there are people there who were acting as guards from Pakistan and from all over the Middle East. But the whole system was set up, with the WTO, frankly, being more of a problem than the government of Qatar, to exclude participation so that there was only one person per NGO allowed a visa in the damn country. So as a result, literally, physically, there were very few people there. And time after time, the WTO would be the one saying, no exceptions, no limit, total limits. The government, for instance, of Qatar, when the Greenpeace Rainbow Warrior sailed into port, which was something that the government had agreed to, a variety of people were on board who didn't have these WTO visas, and the government said, hey, let's just grant them the visas. A lot of people have been scared away. It's fine. There's room for them. And the WTO refused. So, for instance, one of the leading environmental activists from Lebanon was left locked in the port because the WTO, not Qatar, wouldn't let her on shore.
Well, Lori Wallach, we're going to move from Qatar to Ottawa. The quote I just read of the Canadian Finance Minister Paul Martin saying it's important for global financial leaders to meet this weekend in Ottawa. He is meeting there with the world's top finance ministers and heads of the central banks for a meeting of the economic club that Martin heads, known as the G20, a mixed bag of big and small countries. Membership includes Canada, the U.S., Brazil, and the European Union, an informal extension of the G7 group of industrial countries that was set up to allow wider discussion of economic affairs. Close to 1,500 people are expected to attend inside these meetings. Meanwhile, though, the protests outside, as they did during the protests against the free trade area of the America meetings in Quebec City last spring, Canadian authorities are trying to prevent activists from getting into the country. On Monday, lifelong social justice activists Star Hawk and Lisa Fithian were detained at the Canadian border. They'd both been invited by the Ontario Public Interest Research Group to offer trainings on activism in preparation for the demonstrations against the G20, the IMF, and the World Bank. Star Hawk was also scheduled to give a lecture at St. Lawrence University just across the border in the U.S. Both Lisa Fithian and Star Hawk spent nearly 5 hours waiting, being questioned, photographed, fingerprinted, and searched. Lisa Fithian was released just yesterday. We are joined by both of them on the telephone right now. Let's start with Star Hawk. What kinds of questions did the Canadian authorities ask you? Why did they explain? How did they explain why you were being detained?
Mostly they seemed interested in our arrest records. And I think it was my arrest in Seattle at the WTO protest 2 years ago that triggered their computer to finger me. And then Lisa had actually gone through okay, but when they saw we were together, then they pulled her back.
And Lisa Fithian, you just got out yesterday. So how long were you held?
Well, I continuously from about 11 o'clock on Tuesday when I went back for the hearings. So it was about close to 5 hours on Monday night, then from 11 a.m. Tuesday till about 10:30 yesterday morning.
Now, the two of you traveled to Ottawa as part of the group RUD, Radical Action Network of Trainers.
Rant. Not RUD. We're never RUD. We just rant.
Can you explain why you feel the G20 was important to go to, that these meetings?
Well, we felt both the G20 and also the IMF and the World Bank were all meeting here this weekend. And for us, we felt this is a continuation of the work we've been doing for 2 years in the global justice movement of contesting the meetings of these organizations, which are extra-national, which basically set national policies for countries above and beyond any input from citizens.
We also thought it was important because this is actually the first major global summit since 9/11 or September 11th. And there's been a lot of concern about, do we need to stop acting because of this new war? And in fact, you know, we feel that now more than ever, we have to continue to push forward, not just against this war, but also on these issues of global economic justice. So, again, we thought it was really important to keep this on the map, keep momentum in this movement, and to let people know that we're not afraid and that we're going to continue to be out there speaking our truth.
Lori Wallach, can you explain the difference between the WTO and the G20? I think overall, people have a very hard time understanding the differences between all of these meetings. It seems that they're coming every week right now. So both who they are, I mean, you've got the world finance ministers or the G20 finance ministers, why these particular countries come together, along with the leaders of central banks, and how that differs from the WTO.
Well, if you think of corporate globalization as a system that's being created by certain machines, the main machines are the IMF, the World Bank, and the WTO. But a handful of countries, who you might see with the puppet strings above them being pulled by a handful of corporations, are running these machines. And it's largely the so-called G7, but as well now, the G7 has handpicked a set of developing countries that will do more or less what they're told by the G7, so that with a slightly extended group, they can give the facade that the machine is now being run by a more diverse group, when in fact, the policies of the WTO, the IMF, and the World Bank, which you might summarize, if you will, as markets uber alles. The idea is you liberalize trade, you privatize everything in the social sector, you commodify things that are in the common, like the environment or genes, and you basically make a market. The world is nothing but one market. And you create rules to force people and governments to be constrained to that worldview. So that machine and who runs it, obviously, is a matter of political choice and power. And that machine with those big institutions and my colleagues who have been grabbed on the border know that, and, you know, it's why they just said they're going there. The IMF and the World Bank can't get away with having a meeting unless we're there to hold them accountable, because it's part of a three-part operation putting out the product of globalization. Now, that particular meeting of finance ministers, which is not, frankly, different than the kind of pre-meetings they have before a WTO meeting, is, if you will, sort of the cook's cabal to figure out how the policies that are the status quo and further in the status quo direction can be obtained, i.e. how the majority of the world's countries can get steamrolled into being pushed into these policies. And we saw that in Qatar, and there were so-called green rooms, which are invitation-only get-togethers, where basically the trade ministers from the same set of countries whose finance ministers are now on the way to Canada got together and tried to figure out how they could stick it to everyone else.
Starhawk, you have written a piece called Global Justice Activists Detained at Canadian Border, where you compare how the borders are for people versus money around the world, people versus capital. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, the process of corporate globalization is one of opening borders wide open to capital, opening them to corporations, and closing them to people. So the result is that corporations can move freely from place to place in search of the lowest labor costs, in search of the most lax environmental standards, but people can't move freely from place to place in search of better lives, better economic conditions. And that creates tremendous pressure. I mean, what happened to me and Lisa at the border was certainly unpleasant and unfair and a violation of our rights, but it's nothing compared to what happens to people every day on borders. At the Mexican border, people die all through the year from starvation, from hunger, from cold, from exposure as they're trying to cross what's really a military zone, because it's there to keep the people in Mexico who've been displaced from their traditional cultures, from their villages, moving north, moving toward a better life, and they get stuck at the border where their only option is to work for the maquiladoras, the factories that are set up at low wages, set up without any union representation. The border situation there, the ocean at the border is the most polluted anywhere up and down the coast because of the outflows from all of those factories. So open borders really is one of the issues that we're fighting for, open to people looking for asylum. If corporations are going to be able to cross borders, then people need to be able to cross borders. And if these global institutions, which are, again, beyond any nation, are free to move from country to country and place to place, then we need to be free to move from country to country and place to place in order to raise our voices against them.
Well, you're talking about this in perhaps a most repressive time since 50 years ago, when Japanese Americans were interned in World War II, when you have the Attorney General of the United States saying if a person overstays their visa by even one day, they will be arrested, when they're talking about questioning 5,000 men of Middle Eastern descent in this country who came in on business or student or tourist visas, when they're talking seriously about cracking down on immigrants. Lisa Fithian, you're involved with 2 days, the activists who have made it into Ottawa, of rallies and teach-ins, tomorrow joining the issue of fighting corporate globalization with opposing war. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that these are all connected. I mean, really, this war against quote-unquote terrorism is really just another front in their efforts to control world markets and expand capitalism. I also truly believe in some ways it's a diversion. I mean, for many years we've fought the military-industrial complex, and I think they feel they know how to control that. It's kind of the belly of the beast. What we're seeing today is people going after the heart of the beast, which is capitalism. And we have seen how successful we've been over the past few years, you know, really, you know, since 1994, the Zapatista uprising. We've had tremendous impact on what's happening around the world today, and their plans are not inevitable. You know, we really are in play for creating a better world. And they know that. And I think part of this war is an effort to derail this movement, and it's created an opportunity for them to continue to criminalize us. I mean, they've been doing that by shooting us in the streets and trying to paint us all as crazy folks. Now they're actually moving to change the laws that's going to make it easier for them to imprison us and to intimidate people from exercising their rights. So these things are not separate efforts. It's all the same. And as a movement of people who are trying to build a better world, we're going to need to join hands across the world even more and stand up even stronger and speak out even louder right now.
And, you know, one of the ways that they really work is through our fear. And I think that's one of the reasons Lisa made the courageous decision she did to go ahead and contest their decision and not just get on a plane and leave, but to stay and say, no, I want a hearing, and if you're going to have to arrest me, then you're going to have to arrest me. Because each time we make it more costly for them to enforce their decrees, it makes it harder for them to function.
Right.
They function because we're afraid of them and we suppress ourselves.
And they use a lot of intimidation techniques. I mean, I basically risk deportation for life from Canada. And, you know, at some point we just have to call it and say, you know what, this is not right. So
How do you think you ended up in Ottawa?
Sorry?
How did they end up releasing you? Why did they decide to let you go?
Well, I think it was a combination of things. I think it was a result of people from Canada and the United States speaking out and saying this is not acceptable. I think there was a lot of publicity about it. And I think that, you know, people who know me and the work that I have done wrote letters. Technically it was a very fine line. I had some arrests in Denver and in Washington, D.C. as a result of my work on the Justice for Janitors campaign, where we work to get low-wage immigrant janitors health care and pensions and living wages. And I was involved in some nonviolent actions, and on one of them I had a loitering charge. And so the question is they took the position that I had indictable offenses, which is equivalent to a felony. In fact, that was not the case. And so they painted this whole thing that I was a major security risk and press couldn't do this. And I said, you know, I am proud of the work that I have done. I have nothing to be ashamed of. And I would do it again. And I think in the end, they just didn't have the case to keep me out of Canada.
Well, I want to thank you very much all for being with us, Lisa Fithian and Starhawk with RANT, Radical Action Network of Trainers, in Ottawa right now, detained at the Canadian border but made it through. Lori Wallach, Director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, just back from Qatar. We will continue to follow the G20 meetings that take place and the protests that take place against them. You are listening to the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we're going to take a look at a major company that, well, a month ago it would have been unthinkable, Enron, being bought by a much smaller company, the head of Enron being one of George W. Bush's closest friends, Ken Lay. Stay with us.
Why boast of thyself? Oh, evil man. Playing smart and not being clever. Oh, no. I say you're working iniquity to achieve vanity. Yeah. If I so, I so. But the goodness of Jah Jah, I do.
Small Axe, the Wailers, here on the War and Peace Report. This is Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. Enron was a mainstay of Houston's corporate landscape that helped to turn the city into a global energy trading powerhouse. Well, Enron Corporation will disappear in a turn of events that would have been unthinkable a month ago. The smaller rival company, Dynegy, announced on Friday that it will buy the beaten-down Enron in a stock deal worth close to $9 billion. The purchase will end Enron's reign as the world's largest energy trader. A much bigger Dynegy, with annual revenues exceeding $200 billion and $90 billion in assets, will emerge with Chuck Watson, its current chair and chief executive, keeping those roles in the combined company. With Enron's close ties to the Bush administration, many may be wondering how this could have happened. Enron chair Ken Lay is known to have, when Vice President Cheney unveiled his energy plan, questions over Lay's involvement over the or influence over the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission sparked an investigation by the General Accounting Office, close ties to President Bush. According to the Center for Responsive Politics, Lay and other Enron officials spent more than $2 million lobbying the White House last year alone. 70 senators and nearly 200 members of the House have received contributions from Enron. We're joined right now by Laura Goldberg, a business reporter for the Houston Chronicle. Can you lay out for us how this happened?
Sure. There are a number of factors that contributed. First of all, for months now, Wall Street has been asking questions about how Enron did and presented its financial reporting, its financial performance. There were complaints that analysts and investors could not understand Enron's accounting, Enron's books. But those questions sort of were brushed aside or didn't gain broad currency as long as the stock was performing well. You've sort of since had a confluence of factors that has raised those questions to center stage. And last month when Enron released its earnings, it reported significant losses related to some of these complex investment partnerships, some of the very ones that people had complained they couldn't understand. And that sort of made people take notice that maybe something's wrong here. And then the SEC launched an investigation into Enron, too, and quickly market confidence plunged, the stock price dropped significantly, and led to the unraveling of the company.
Harvey Rosenfield, you're a consumer advocate. Can you talk about the significance of this?
Well, this is a company that had promoted one of the worst public policy disasters in our country, which is the deregulation of electricity. Enron and its CEO, Ken Lay, beginning in the early 90s, basically took a dog and pony show across the United States, urging state legislators to support removal of state regulatory controls over the sale of electricity. In most cases, these are regulatory systems that were set up at the beginning of the last century after price profiteering by private energy companies showed that these were best treated as public monopolies. So Ken Lay and Enron were actively involved in the 1996 deregulation of electricity here in California. And I think most Americans know what's happened since then, particularly this year, when because of deregulation, the average electricity rate's gone up about 50% and will go up over the next 20 years, probably another by revenues about, I'd say, $50 billion just to pay for the unraveling of deregulation. And Enron was right at the center of that deregulation effort and profited enormously at the beginning. I mean, the CEO, Ken Lay himself, walked away last year with $250 million in compensation.
When I was covering Congress in the beginning of the Republican Revolution, when Newt Gingrich took power, the Republicans did, in 1994, Enron, it seemed, was testifying at every committee hearing. Tremendous power in Congress. In countries like India, whole consumer groups have formed just to deal with Enron. Can you talk Harvey Rosenfield about the what Lay's close relationship with the Republicans did for his company.
Well, I can't talk exactly about that because I think none of us really know for sure, but I could tell you what it looked like from the outside. He was very close to the current president, George Bush. He boasted himself, and it was well known that he and his company's executives pre-screened Bush appointees to high posts, such as FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, which is supposed to regulate wholesale energy suppliers across the country, as well as other federal agencies that would have any effect on Enron's business and on the business of trading electricity, which is what Enron basically did. They were everywhere in Sacramento when deregulation passed in 1996. They were considered among those who were the chief proponents of it, ramrodding it through the legislature so that, in effect, in 1996, there were no votes against it by either party. In other words, it passed unanimously.
Can you talk, Laura Goldberg of the Houston Chronicle, about what are off-balance sheet finance vehicles?
Sure. They're actually fairly commonly used among companies that have big capital-related purchases. You'll see trucking companies or airlines use them. They're essentially a way of making investments. You set up these investment partnerships or vehicles to make investments, and the debt doesn't immediately show up on your balance sheet, so it doesn't look like you have taken on too much debt. And if all goes according to plan, the investments work out, and no problems are ever detected. But what Enron did differently were several things. For one, the partnerships that have brought most attention were actually run by an Enron insider, the chief financial officer. And most often when these things are set up, it's outsiders that run them. And what happened here is there's been a conflict of interest alleged. The question arises, how can someone whose responsibility is supposed to be to Enron and its shareholders also be responsible to this investment partnership? And the other things that Enron did differently are their transactions were so much more complex than people were used to seeing. They just had a hard time figuring out what was going on.
So what happens right now? You have a smaller company, Dynegy, that takes over Enron. The head of Dynegy will be the head of this new massive corporation. So it's not that a big company went down. It's that a bigger one has been created.
That's correct. And it remains to be seen how many of Enron's traders, which are considered some of the key employees, will actually stay and go to the combined company, and how many will seek employment elsewhere. We haven't gotten any word yet on the number of layoffs that we can expect as a result of the merger. And the key, I guess, for Dynegy will be whether it can actually successfully integrate the two companies, which do have some difference in their cultures.
And what does Ken Lay do?
Well, Ken Lay will not have a management role with the day-to-day company. He has been offered a seat on the board, but he has not decided whether to accept it. And there's been some pressure from some investors, including some who filed lawsuits, for him not to have a seat on the merged board, but he hasn't made a decision yet.
Finally, what does this mean as a consumer advocate, Harvey Rosenfield, to have this massive corporation?
Well, if you believe in karma, then you see that a terrible and costly mistake in public policy, one which will certainly rival the savings and loans fiasco, and I'm talking about electricity deregulation, has come home to roost. This is the company that was described, quote, as the genius behind energy deregulation. It was a high-flying company. It traded in electricity as if it were a commodity. Reaped the rewards of the deregulation law it sponsored, but ultimately its greed and its arrogance brought it down. And, of course, here in California, deregulation has also brought down the state's utility companies, one of which is in bankruptcy and one of which will go into bankruptcy if consumer groups can reverse a bailout deal negotiated in federal court. The state itself has put out $10 billion to buy electricity in the year 2001 from taxpayers' money. Another $50 billion in long-term contracts at inflated prices were signed. So first you had the utilities rip off the public, then you had the energy companies rip off the utilities, and now you have the energy companies like Enron traders falling into the ditch themselves. It's sort of the bigger they are, the harder they fall.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us to talk about Enron and, well, now Dynegy. Laura Goldberg, business reporter for the Houston Chronicle, and Harvey Rosenfield at consumerwatchdog.org. And that does it for our program. I'm very much looking forward to meeting listeners in Troy, New York, tonight on November 16th at 7 p.m. I'll be at RPI's Chapel and Cultural Center at 2125 Burdett Avenue in Troy, celebrating WRPI and a fundraiser for them. Then I head to Washington, D.C. for the Pacifica National Board meeting. And tomorrow night, there'll be a gathering at All Souls Church at Columbia and 16th Street from 6 to 9. And among those will be the son of the founder of Pacifica Radio. Lou Hill was the founder. His son, David Moore, will be speaking. Also, my former co-host of Democracy Now!, Juan Gonzalez, will be there, and I will be as well. That's Saturday night, November 17th at All Souls Church, which is at Columbia and 16th Street in Washington, D.C. And, of course, we'll be at the Pacifica National Board meeting as we talk about issues of, well, the original mission of Pacifica, a radio network founded by a man who refused to fight in a war. It was World War II, came out of jail and said there has to be a media network that's not run by corporate philosophy or by corporations, but run by journalists and artists. That does it for today's program. If you'd like to email us, you can send us mail at mail@democracynow.org. That's mail@democracynow.org. We're still looking to enhance our workstations at our Firehouse in exile from the embattled studios of WBAI. If you can help us in getting Macintosh laptop computers, that is the route we're going to go. Please email us and let us know. That's mail@democracynow.org. Democracy Now! In Exile is produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, and Miranda Kennedy. Anthony Sloan is our engineer and music maestro. We want to thank KPFA and KFCF, Amy Pomerlow at KPFA in particular, and Aaron Glantz at Free Speech Radio News. We want to thank all our Pacifica affiliates. We are Pacifica. Judy Gorman was our in-house musician today, and thank you for that, Judy. We're heard in New York at WFMU 91.1 every night at 7, Manhattan Neighborhood Network, channels 34 and 36, and Free Speech TV, channel 9415 on the Dish Network. In exile from the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of the Band of the Fire, the studios of our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
Ready to put you down. Thank you.
Shall bury you.